Please be advised that this serving of AIDS, the Lost Voices, may cause offense or upset, as...
I've got a bit of a potty mouth. I mean, I can't help it. Well, I can help it, but you know, this subject just gets me so fired up that the odd swear word just falls out every now and again. Anyway, if you've got sensitive ears, or you're around people with sensitive ears, then perhaps tune in later. Don't tune in at all. Pop in some headphones. I don't give a f***. Anyway, let's get this show started. Roll it.
AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to Extra Tea with your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Gloria.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s, and noughties.
Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it. Hey!
Yay, we're back for another week for another episode of AIDS, the Lost Voices. And how are you, Gloria?
Apart from being baked alive on the subway, I'm good, thanks.
Good, good. And for anybody wondering where we are, Gloria is referring to the Tube here in London, the London Underground.
Ah, yes, I forgot you guys call it the Tube.
And I know you're probably usually snorting lines, but which line did you travel on today?
Well, I came from Marble Arch. I had to hop on the Central Line and change to the Victoria Line at Oxford Circus.
Oh, the Central Line is the worst for the heat.
It was just hot and smelly, but I'm here now.
Yeah, you are a bit whiffy, actually. Oof, gosh, right, should we stop with the whittering and get stuck in?
Let's do it. In this episode, we are looking at three doctors. Dr. Curran, Dr. Shuttleworth, and Dr. Clayton.
Mm-hmm.
And how are they all connected?
Well, their only connection really is the fact that they all died of AIDS or an AIDS-related illness, and then vilified in the newspapers, with the newspapers often citing all three of them together.
So, the first is the News of the World newspaper running a story exposing Dr. Curran as having AIDS on Sunday, July 5th, 1992.
That's right. Although I don't have the News of the World article because they haven't submitted their newspapers to the British Library newspaper archives. But we do know this was the nature of the article because Dr. Curran's employer, in various other articles, confirmed that Dr. Curran had informed them that he'd been approached by the tabloid and that the tabloid intended to not only run a story, but name Dr. Curran within it.
How did they get away with this kind of behavior? Bigger question, how did they even find out?
Do you know, it's really hard to kind of establish that, but a lot of personal stories like this often start life in the tabloids because someone will have no doubt approached them with the story for some kind of financial exchange or some kind of act of revenge. Anyhow, the Sunday Mirror report on the story, as does the Independent on Sunday, and both their articles are very similar, except the Daily Mirror has longer quotes, which will give us more of an insight into what's going on. So it's the front page of the Sunday Mirror on the 5th of July 1992, under the headline, Top Doc AIDS Alert. A top hospital set up an AIDS advice helpline for former patients last night after a surgeon became the centre of an AIDS virus scare. Eye specialist Dr. Peter Curran, who works at Queen Mary Hospital in Sidcup, Kent, is on leave following worries about his health. A spokesman said Mr. Curran, who has also worked at several famous London hospitals, would not confirm or deny that he was HIV positive. Full story, page 2. So let's turn to page 2.
Okay.
And the headline reads, Top Surgeon in AIDS Alert, with a strapline, Eye Specialist Goes on Leave After Virus Scare. And the article reads, A top eye surgeon at a large NH hospital was named last night in an AIDS virus alert. A special helpline for the consultant's worried patients has been set up at the 644-bed Queen Mary Hospital in Sidcup, Kent. The consultant was named as ophthalmic surgeon Mr. Peter Curran, who is in his 40s. Jim Tyndall, chief executive of Bexley Health Authority, said he telephoned the hospital to say he was going to be named in a newspaper article this Sunday, but refused to confirm or deny whether he was HIV positive. He has been with us 10 years. I do not know his marital status. We believe he has been taking advice from a specialist in communicable diseases. But the Department of Health advises that, as an ophthalmic surgeon, he was not in a high-risk area. A helpline with AIDS counsellors will be set up at the hospital from Sunday morning. A spokesman for Bexley Health Authority said, The health authority has taken expert advice and does not consider there to be any risk to patients treated by Mr. Curran. Patients can be assured that information given will not be recorded on any records. Mr. Curran is currently on leave and his clinics have been covered by a locum. The hospital chief executive, Stephen Collinson, added that Mr. Curran had refused to confirm or deny he has the virus and has a week's leave booked. Former colleague, retired consultant surgeon David Lewis, said, quote, "Peter is a very nice, quiet, hardworking man. I am astonished by the news." Advice from the General Medical Council is that any doctor involved in a situation like this should seek the advice of qualified colleagues. Mr. Curran, who lives in South London, studied medicine at Oxford University and has worked at London's Moorfields Eye Hospital. He has also worked at Westminster Hospital and the Middlesex Hospital, London.
His employer, the hospital setting up an AIDS helpline, is surely only adding fuel to the fire.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's that balancing act between patients reading the story and wanting to seek reassurance via a telephone line. But
yeah,
the helpline being called an AIDS helpline for the purpose of receiving calls from worried patients treated by Dr. Curran implies he has HIV/AIDS, no?
I thought that.
It's ridiculous. So I do think that possibly these lines are just, they spring up immediately because they know that they're going to get an influx of calls. And if they can get them through to just this dedicated AIDS line, it frees up the hospital's main line, so to speak,
yeah,
because of the hysteria and how hysterical people are around HIV/AIDS at the time.
And I see from the file, this story just grows and grows.
Yes, because the next day, Monday, papers are using headlines that allude to Dr. Curran being on the run.
No way.
When in fact, he is just on annual leave and
yeah,
the hospital have said that they can't get a hold of him. I mean, it's 1992, an age when you sent a postcard instead of an email and you rewound the answer machine tape instead of packing your phone charger when going on holiday. You know, that's the level of communication. Things weren't as instant as they are today.
The Evening Standard newspaper reports, "Meanwhile, the 45-year-old surgeon, who has taken a week's leave, has made no attempt to contact his employers, whom he had not told of his condition."
Oh, well, really, it's kind of a bit of a contradiction there in itself, you know, a bit of false reporting, because in the article that we've just read, his employers essentially have said that he's called in to the hospital to warn them that this article is going to go out in the News of the World newspaper or the Sunday tabloid, and that he wouldn't confirm or deny whether he was HIV/AIDS positive or not. So that's a very misleading. It's incorrect that he's on the run and that he's not willing to speak to his employers because he's already spoken to them.
I
just
agree.
Can't get my head around why the newspapers are so adamant that he has HIV/AIDS to make these claims.
Interestingly, in the same newspaper, it states, "The CEO at the hospital, Mr. Stephen Collinson, admitted today there was no obligation for him to let us know. He did not have to tell us."
And interestingly, I suspect this is the hospital that the CEO, Stephen Collinson, now seeing what's playing out in the newspapers and thinking, well, actually, you know, we would have quite liked to have known, you know, for whatever reason. But I think they're trying to just quell the press a little bit by saying, look, he didn't have to tell us. He's done the right thing. He called into the hospital and told us. But I kind of feel for the hospital that they've brought a lot of this on themselves because they gave those immediate responses to the newspapers saying that he's not here. He won't confirm or deny whether he's got HIV. So they've only fueled all of this, I feel, anyway. But I don't think it's helpful because the next couple of days, this story rumbles on and does explode. You have newspapers that are alleging there's a search on for Dr. Curran, or as the Aberdeen Journal stated, there's a, quote, hunt for Dr. Curran.
That's awful.
And, you know, we see on the 7th of July, 1992, the Daily Mirror reports on its front page with the headline and a photograph of Dr. Curran's face, "HIV doc living with a jailbird skinhead he met in a gay bar."
Man.
Anyhow, the article reads, "AIDS scare surgeon Peter Curran lives with an ex-convict he met in a gay bar, the Mirror can reveal." Well done, the Mirror. "The 25-year-old skinhead, who gave his name only as Stuart, has shared Curran's home for several years. The consultant befriended him in a London pub used by homosexuals after he left jail. Curran, 45, sparked an AIDS alert after claims he carried out 140 operations while HIV positive. Last night he was still in hiding and Stuart said, quote, he is nervous and very afraid. He said he spoke to Curran on the phone for an hour yesterday and added, quote, he is devastated. He feels as though he is trapped like a cornered animal and does not know which way to turn. He feels let down by all his friends."
That is sad.
Stuart, a catering manager in a London hotel, said Curran knew hospital bosses had pleaded for him to come forward. Quote, "Peter wants to tell his side of the story when the time is right," he said. He hopes to say something within the next few days. Stewart said the £90,000 a year eye consultant suspected he had the AIDS virus 2.5 years ago. He said, about 6 months ago, a close friend of his in Oxford died of AIDS and Peter feared the worst.
Yes, but saying Peter suspected he had the AIDS and seeing his friend die of it is not a confirmed diagnosis.
Exactly, and I think this friend of his, this Stewart, is trying to help.
Yeah.
But I think he's only adding more fuel and speculation to what's going on. You know, I suppose when you're hearing constantly in the press and the media, the gay plague, and you are gay, you're probably thinking, like many have said before, I'm really shocked that I didn't get it. Or many that do get an HIV AIDS diagnosis go, well, I knew it was coming. It was bound to come. We've heard this in some of the stories that we've spoken about in previous episodes. So, you can't read too much into that. It's not a confirmation, is it?
And in the Kent Evening Post, one of Dr. Curran's eye patients comes to his defense.
Because on the 8th of July 1992, they ran with the headline, "Stop Panic Over AIDS Scared Doctor." And the article reads, "A patient of eye surgeon Peter Curran, said to have performed 140 operations while infected with the AIDS virus, pleaded today, quote, stop the panic. Health officials urgently want to talk to Mr. Curran following a Sunday newspaper report that he worked while carrying the HIV virus. He is on holiday and has not made contact with colleagues at Westhill Hospital, Dartford, or Queen Mary's in Sidcup since it became public on Sunday. One of his patients, 64-year-old Kenneth Blackman, said, and I quote, the man's a marvel. He saved my sight and has saved many other people's too. He should be treated with some sympathy and respect, not like some man on the run.
Well said.
Toolmaker, Mr. Blackman, said the News of the World story had triggered, quote, hysterical overreaction.
Yeah.
Much of Mr. Curran's work is done with laser surgery, which cannot possibly carry any risk of HIV infection, said Mr. Blackman. And where there is traditional surgery, gloves are worn and any risk is so small as to be insignificant. Mr. Curran is a great man, and it is terrible to see him and his career crucified like this. The person who shopped him is despicable. Mr. Blackman, from Hextable, near Dartford, faced blindness when diabetes raised blood pressure behind his eyes. Mr. Curran, whose patients come from the Dartford, Gravesham and Bexley area, saved his sight with laser surgery. Mr. Blackman, still having progress checks, said, if I need scalpel surgery tomorrow, I'd let Mr. Curran do it without a moment's hesitation. In fact, I wouldn't want anyone else.
Awesome.
Oh, God, Mr. Blackman.
Yeah.
The £90,000 a year surgeon who treats private and NHS patients has not broken the law, so police cannot be called to help trace him. Queen Mary's has stressed there is not one recorded case worldwide of a surgeon transferring the HIV virus to a patient during surgery. But callers have flooded a special helpline set up to advise anxious patients. Oh, get a life. Royal College of Surgeon guidelines say a surgeon known to be HIV positive would not normally be involved in, quote, major invasive surgery.
How refreshing. I wonder how many people stopped to really think if they were overreacting.
Having lost Freddie Mercury in 1991, you would hope that the stigma had dropped ever so slightly and perhaps his legacy would be that people educated themselves on what HIV was and how it really affected people.
And on the same day, Dr. Curran had a meeting with his employer, accompanied by his solicitor.
Yes, that happens, as you say, on the same day, the 8th of July, and it doesn't get reported until the following day in the Daily Mirror on the 9th of July, 1992.
Okay.
Now, the headline reads, surgeon in AIDS row sees his boss, and there's a headshot of Dr. Peter Curran as well. And the article states, AIDS scare surgeon Peter Curran returned yesterday to face his bosses and try to reassure his worried patients. The £90,000 a year eye consultant, alleged to have carried out 140 operations while HIV positive, denied exposing anyone to needless risk. But health chiefs promised he would undergo full medical checks before being allowed back into the operating theatre. Mr. Curran, 45, of Kennington, London, went on leave a week ago after reporters quizzed him. His lawyer was with him at his meeting yesterday with Stephen Collinson, chief executive of Queen Mary's Hospital, Sidcup, Kent, where a helpline has been set up for anxious patients. Mr. Curran will be on leave for at least another month. It is understood that he is planning to spend time abroad.
Well, we don't learn much from that.
Well, after this meeting, a joint statement was released by Dr. Peter Curran and the Bexley Health Authority, and some of it is quoted in the Kent Evening Post on the same day.
Huh.
And Dr. Peter Curran is quoted as saying, Like any doctor, I am familiar with all the official guidelines relating to the control of infection in medical practice. In 20 years of practice, I have never knowingly, by act or admission, exposed any patient to any needless risk.
And in the statement from the health authority, his employer states, reports suggesting that Mr. Curran had disappeared were misleading.
Well, I hate to say it, but I think you'd have to be a bit of an idiot to have believed the newspapers when they said that he'd disappeared and the tabloids alluding that he'd gone on the run and there was a manhunt for him, because the guy was on annual leave. That was clear, I feel, from the outset, no?
Yeah.
And it's just a shame that his annual leave, his holiday, by his friend Stuart's own admission, was for him to go into, quote, hiding.
Yeah.
And the health authority said that Dr. Curran was concerned about the effect the publicity surrounding him might have on his patients and the hospital's reputation. He felt, and I quote, very sad that this situation has received such negative press.
And from the other reports that said he had gone into hiding, suggests it had all become extremely overwhelming for him.
Absolutely, and getting this kind of press attention, especially at this time, 1992, and there's still the HIV/AIDS stigma, can you blame him? I mean, his friend Stuart said it was one of his friends who made the allegation to a newspaper, the News of the World. And remember the friend and colleague that said, quote, Peter is a very nice man, quiet and hardworking.
Yeah.
This, I would imagine, would do untold damage on someone's mental health, regardless of his professional standing as a doctor or surgeon. This is going to have an impact on him.
And with his employer granting special leave mid-July, this is extended again in mid-August.
Yes, and given this had grown into a national story, this little snippet of information, like all the other articles, made it into all the papers up and down the country. And for 7 months, all goes quiet.
Oh.
Until March 1993, when the press report on AIDS claims regarding Dr. Peter Clayton and Dr. Terence Shuttleworth. Now, the press refers back to the story of Dr. Peter Curran, who we've just spoken about, as being of a similar concern, and within their reporting, they share what happened next to Dr. Curran.
Huh.
The People newspaper on the 7th of March 1993 cite Dr. Curran and state, quote, in January, gay eye surgeon Peter Curran quit the NHS after a massive payoff from Bexleyheath Health Authority in Kent. He still practices in private hospital. What happened next? I have no idea.
I think we all know what happened there. It's just sad, as he seemed dedicated to his patients at the hospital.
Mm. And as for the newspapers in 1992 claiming Dr. Peter Curran was gravely ill, it was 4 years before he sadly passed away, the day after his 49th birthday.
That is sad.
On the 23rd of May, 1996. He was survived by his 90-year-old mother, Alice, who at the time of the newspaper reports was in a retirement home. Some newspapers claimed that the staff at the retirement home had to disconnect the television in her room to protect her from the news reports about her son. She died 2 years later in 1998 at the age of 92. Dr. Peter Curran's estate was granted by probate on the 23rd of October 1996 in London, having been cremated in Kensington and Chelsea on the 31st of May 1996.
Ah. So how do Dr. Clayton and Dr. Shuttleworth fit into all of this?
Well, in this case of Dr. Peter Edward Clayton, he hit the headlines up and down the country on the 10th of March 1993. Now, it was the Sunderland Echo that really did a copy and paste of various articles and merged them into one. Which I'll read now,
okay.
Where the headline states, new scare after AIDS doctor dies. And the article reads, a junior doctor who worked in hospitals in South Wales died of AIDS last October, health chiefs said today. Dr. Peter Clayton, 28, a married man, worked as a trainee general practitioner at a number of hospitals and also helped at a surgery at Bridge End, Mid Glamorgan. Mid Glamorgan Health Authority said today it was not aware of his illness until his death. It stressed the doctor's work with patients was of such a nature as to make the likelihood of transmitting the HIV virus virtually nil. However, 4 telephone helplines have been set up for former patients and HIV tests are being offered to those wanting them. Dr. Clayton of Bridgend, married to a nurse, first became ill while spending a 12-month attachment in Bermuda between August 1990 and July 1991, said a health authority statement. On returning to South Wales, he continued his GP training at a group practice in Bridgend until November 1991 when he stopped work. He died the following October. The statement said the doctor left medical school in 1987 and did his first trainee job in general medicine at East Glamorgan Hospital between August 1987 and January 1988. He then worked in general surgery at the University Hospital of Wales in Cardiff between February 1988 and July 1988. He became a trainee GP in August 1988 at the Oldcastle Surgery Bridge End until January 31st, 1989, when he started a separate trainee attachment at the Princess of Wales Hospital Bridge End, which lasted until July 1990. Quote, "At no time during his stay at the Princess of Wales Hospital did he display any symptoms," said the statement.
And the following day, on March 11th, 1993, the Daily Mirror ran the headline, AIDS Doc Cover-Up, with a strapline, "Health Bosses Keep Young GP's Death Secret for 5 Months."
Yes, and there is a headshot of Dr. Clayton smiling along with a photograph of the hospital and even Dr. Clayton's semi-detached home.
Wow.
How they got away with that, I don't know. Now, it's a long article, much we already know, so I'll just pick out additional detail.
Okay.
In regards to the, quote, cover-up headline, the article states, "Yesterday, Public Health Chief Dr. Bill Smith admitted he decided on the cover-up and said, quote, 'There is an element of what they don't know won't hurt them, but I made my decision on what was in the best public interest. We only knew that Dr. Clayton was suffering from AIDS just before his death. He had not worked for the health authority for almost a year, so we don't know whether he had the disease while he was here.'"
Two very different approaches. Dr. Curran's health authority opened an AIDS helpline alluding he was living with HIV/AIDS. And here, Dr. Clayton's health authority wants to keep it quiet. It makes you wonder how it came out at all.
Well, you should never believe what you read in the newspaper, I know that, but
really?
The Daily Mirror says, "Health bosses in Mid-Glamorgan were told of Dr. Clayton's illness, but the cause of his death only emerged after an anonymous letter to a local newspaper." And in this article, we also get to hear from Dr. Clayton's neighbours, where the article states, "Reg and Avis Bailey described the GP and his wife as the ideal couple. Mr. Bailey said, quote, 'We only found out today that Peter died from AIDS. He had looked terribly ill in the last few months. He was grey and gaunt like an old man. Sally is a lovely girl and Peter had a wonderful manner. Everyone liked him.' Medical chiefs said Mrs. Clayton was being looked after at a secret address."
The fact his wife Sally had to move to a secret address is horrendous.
Oh, absolutely. Isn't it just mind-bending? Just, you know, you really got to wrap your head around it, that this is the impact of stories that appear in the newspapers, especially around HIV/AIDS, that she's having to be whisked off to a secret location. I'd be so defiant. I'd be like, you know, I'm not leaving my house. Why should I, I leave? But so this was the sign of the times, really, even in the early 90s. And it will come as no surprise that Dr. Clayton's continues to appear in stories in the days that follow, because in the same week, a third doctor who died of AIDS the previous summer in a Bolton hospital has also been outed, although he hasn't been named in the press and seems to remain anonymous. But authorities, knowing who he was, set up a helpline at the hospital. And to rewind 5 months to when Dr. Clayton passed away, I did find his obituary in the South Wales Echo from the 20th of October 1992, which reads, "On October 17, 1992, peacefully and gently, at home, Dr. Peter Edward Clayton, aged 28 years, of Davis Avenue, deeply loved husband of Sally, beloved youngest son of Nan and Ron, loving brother of Mo and Ron, and much loved son-in-law of Dorothy and Ray, brother-in-law and uncle, fond memories and thoughts of happy days he shared with everyone."
When you say Dr. Clayton was the second, and the unnamed doctor was the third, does that mean Dr. Terence Shuttleworth was the first?
That's right. All in the space of a single week, the press reported up and down the country on the unnamed doctor in Bolton, which was only a brief story, Dr. Clayton and Dr. Shuttleworth. They pulled in Dr. Curran from the previous year to just whip up this storm of frenzy.
Yeah.
In having the public question their safety around HIV/AIDS and those that they may seek treatment from the medical profession.
Good point.
Now, the next doctor, Dr. Shuttleworth, the onslaught that he must have faced must have been horrendous.
Oh, no.
He was in every paper up and down the country every single day right up until his death and even after it.
The Sunday Life newspaper on March 7th, 1993 ran the headline, "Hospital Doctor Seriously Ill with AIDS."
Yes, he made all the tabloids, the nationals, the regionals, but it was this newspaper gives us a more condensed version of the story, and it reads, "A consultant gynecologist and obstetrician was seriously ill in hospital last night after being diagnosed HIV positive, a health authority said. Terence Shuttleworth, who practiced mainly at All Saints Hospital, Chatham, Kent, was estimated to have treated up to 17,000 patients over the last 10 years, Medway Health Authority said. District General Manager Ken Hexworth told a news conference at Medway Hospital, Gillingham, that the authority learned Mr. Shuttleworth was diagnosed as having AIDS virus on Friday. The authority wishes to stress that the likelihood of transmission of HIV infection to any patients is extremely remote. No case of a doctor, nurse, or midwife infecting patients through their practice has ever been recorded worldwide, he said. He added, women who had a normal birth are not at risk at all. Mr. Hexworth said Mr. Shuttleworth had been on duty in the Medway area, quote, until the last few days, and in recent years the majority of his work had been in gynaecology rather than obstetrics. He said preparations to make confidential testing available to all who wanted it were underway, as were the checks on records over the last decade. He hoped concerned patients would contact the hospital in the first instance, but the hospital would also be trying to contact all 17,000 patients as soon as possible.
Wow.
He emphasised the risk to patients was, quote, negligible, given that it would only occur during blood-to-blood contact as, quote, when a doctor cuts himself during invasive surgery. The latest scare comes just weeks after another alert in Kent when it was revealed that a midwife who delivered 42 babies over a 23-month period at Farnborough Hospital, Orpington, had the HIV virus. And the Sunday Mirror went with the headline, Baby Doc Sparks Huge AIDS Scare, with the strapline, 17,000 patients to be offered tests. And in the article, one of the hospital workers is quoted as saying, I was shocked. This gynecologist delivered a friend's child a few weeks ago. I had my test and have to wait for the result. It's worrying. I don't understand how a doctor is not subject to regular screening.
Wow.
And exactly how did they think they'd contract it from Dr. Shuttleworth? Sharing the cutlery in the hospital canteen?
Do you know, it's just a massive overreaction, isn't it? And it's just, I can't get my head around it. I mean, unless there's something gone on between work colleagues that we don't know about, because we don't know if this person is a female or a male, because we do know that Dr. Shuttleworth was gay. Why they'd be wanting to take a test? Because you would just assume in the normal work environment that your contact has just been just passing each other in the corridor, say perhaps just sharing the cutlery in the canteen. It's just weird, but hey-ho, this person's taking a test and they're waiting for the results, so. Anyhow, by the next day, given precedent set by newspapers, especially tabloids, photos of Dr. Shuttleworth start appearing in the newspapers. On the 8th of March 1993, the Daily Mirror headline is 4,000 women in fear jam AIDS doc phones. The Birmingham Mail, with photos of Dr. Shuttleworth, ran the headline, call for GPs to have AIDS tests.
Oh, man.
And the Daily Post in Wales has a huge front page headline that says, fear floods HIV hotline. I mean, you get the picture of where we're going.
Yeah,
this.
Panic.
Absolutely panic. It reminds me of the scene from Chicken Run.
We mustn't panic. We mustn't panic.
And it's funny you say that, because the next day, on the 9th of March 1993, the Chatham Standard, which would have been a local paper to Dr. Shuttleworth, ran the headline that almost covers the whole front page, which reads, stay calm. And the following day, on the 10th of March 1998, the Kent Gazette, another local paper, runs a front page headline, don't panic.
But the irony is, it's the newspaper's own reporting causing the panic.
Exactly. Although, from time to time, you do see amongst local newspapers and local journalists less sensationalism when it comes to stories of their local community, you know, their readers.
Uh-huh.
And I think in this case, compared to the tabloids, this isn't about shifting copies and generating revenue through sensationalist headlines and stories.
Mm.
And if we go back a day,
okay,
to the 9th of March 1993, it was the front page of the Daily Mirror that really gave me a sinking feeling in my stomach, because they publish a large photo of Dr. Terence Shuttleworth on its front page with the headline, humiliated. Now, you'd be forgiven if looking at the front page, you didn't realise that the headline is in connection with John Major being humiliated.
Really?
By 26 Tory rebels who voted with Labour on the, I can't even say it, the Maastricht Treaty. Anyhow, because the photo of Dr. Shuttleworth takes up a quarter of the page, He looks a little serious or glum. It looks like one of those snaps where you're caught off guard, and it seems he's perhaps listening to someone in conversation. As you see, the image as well is severely cropped. It's at the forefront of the newspaper, so, you know, and it's under this headline.
I see what you mean. Very clever placement of the headline, humiliating.
Clever, but I think really, to a degree, it's just very manipulative, I'd say. Anyhow, the headline at the side of Dr. Shuttleworth's photo reads, "The AIDS Doc." And the strapline that they've underlined for emphasis reads, "Surgeon may have known he had virus." The headline and the photograph just made my heart sink for Dr. Shuttleworth, who, by all reports, say he's in hospital seriously ill with AIDS, although he did inform the health authority to share that he had tested positive for HIV.
You'd only hope he wasn't shown the newspapers while he's in the hospital.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously a very clever man, very intelligent. He's of a certain age.
Yeah.
I think he'd be able to handle this, but it wouldn't be pleasant by any means, would it? So I agree with you, actually. I hope he wasn't shown these or didn't see these newspaper stories and headlines, especially from the tabloids.
Yeah.
But it kind of strikes me that he wouldn't be the kind of man that would read the tabloid junk. And as the story continues inside, there are more headlines. HIV, we should know the truth about our doctors. And from the front page article, the headline inside reads, "Face of AIDS Man." Now, the story outlines the Department of Health are commenting and saying that Dr. Shuttleworth has been tested positive for HIV, and he himself has requested for that information to be released publicly. And interestingly, the Department of Health, when asked if Dr. Shuttleworth has, quote, full-blown AIDS, they stated they will not disclose that information as it's confidential information between Dr. Shuttleworth as a patient and his doctor taking care of him in the hospital. And they also state to the Daily Mirror journalist, quote, "Mr. Shuttleworth has not broken any law and it is not a matter for us."
But it seems the lack of comment or confirmation led the journalists to do some digging of their own.
Yes, because as I mentioned earlier, over the coming days, Dr. Shuttleworth, Dr. Curran and the late Dr. Clayton all feature in articles prompting the public to think twice about the professionals they turned to if they felt sick. And on the 11th of March 1993, the Daily Mirror printed a small piece titled "HIV Man's Sex Shame." Now, this is picked up the following day by his local paper, the Chatham News, who make it front page news. And the headline reads, "AIDS doctor's sex offences go back 30 years. Shuttleworth's criminal record revealed."
This doesn't sound good.
With headlines like that, no, it doesn't sound good at all. But I'd say don't be too judgy just yet.
Really?
Remember, I know what's coming.
Okay.
So don't be too judgy yet. Relax. And so let's take a look at the articles. The article reads, "Medway gynecologist Terence Shuttleworth, who is seriously ill with AIDS, was convicted of sex offences 30 years ago when he was a young doctor." Now, further down the article, it states, "Mr. Shuttleworth, who is in his 50s, was conditionally discharged at Bradford Quarter Sessions for gross indecency in 1962. A year later, he was fined £25 at Bow Street, London, for importuning for an immoral purpose, approaching men for sex."
I don't even understand these alleged charges.
Well, I know what it all means because, you know, I learned this from my peers. But to ensure I give accurate information, we're going to turn to the internet. So according to many sources on the internet, the first charge of 1962 of, quote, "gross indecency" in the 1960s and decades after was said to mean, and I quote, "sexual activity between men that fell short of sodomy." And that's from Wikipedia, Gross Indecency UK. Now, remember the Sexual Offences Act we spoke about in the Martin Johnson episode?
Yes, when England partially decriminalised homosexuality.
Yes, you were listening. Right, before the change in law in 1967, namely 1962, when Dr. Shuttleworth was before the Bradford Court, we had the Sexual Offences Act 1956, where it was illegal to, remember, the word procure men. So if you were caught kissing, holding hands, or even chatting up another man, you could be arrested under gross indecency. And I suspect people reading the papers in 1993 would have conjured up images of him perhaps flashing or exposing himself from a rain mac, or perhaps engaging in indecent or sexual acts, when he was merely charged with gross indecency, which could have been chatting up, kissing maybe, but strip it back, he was in trouble for merely being gay. Now, the second charge of, quote, "importuning for an immoral purpose," the newspapers clarifies for its readers as, quote, "approaching men for sex." Now, many famous men at the time were charged and fined for this act, many of which referred to it as cottaging, but it could have happened anywhere. But again, retrospectively looking back, it is incredibly harmless. People go out today, get drunk in a bar, invite a guy back.
Exactly.
This, in a nutshell, is what they class as importuning for an immoral purpose. Huh. But we have to accept this was illegal at the time. But I felt it right to highlight Dr. Shuttleworth was convicted for merely being gay and not some sex pest, as the papers allude.
Okay.
Now, this article goes on to share he appeared before the General Medical Council Disciplinary Committee in 1964. After his case was postponed twice, he was told in 1966 that no further action would be taken.
If it wasn't an issue for the General Medical Council in 1964, it makes you wonder why the newspaper is making a fuss about it in 1993.
Well, I think, on a whole, we know why. None of us are stupid. We all know why, especially those that lived through the times, grew up with the times, and those that, oh, I use the term loosely, but have learned the lesbian and gay history since.
Uh-huh.
Because it's just a means to associate a gay man with HIV AIDS as a sex pest, a pedo, you know, somebody who's unhinged and somebody that you shouldn't respect in society. That's really what the newspaper is getting at. But
insert silent pause.
Yeah, bitch, those are the production directions. We don't read those. But
you're such a shady bitch.
Everything I just told you was to a degree irrelevant.
You'll have to explain, because I'm lost.
Well, those two convictions against Dr. Shuttleworth for gross indecency and importuning for immoral purposes, and which we've just gone through and explained what they were all about. Breaking news. Dr. Terence Shuttleworth was officially and posthumously pardoned for both of those convictions as of the 31st of January 2017. This was under a piece of legislation referred to as Turing's Law, named after gay Enigma codebreaker Alan Turing, who, like Dr. Terence Shuttleworth, was also convicted for gross indecency. The formal name for the legislation that gained royal assent is the Police and Crime Act 2017. So those convictions that Dr. Shuttleworth received have gone,
awesome.
Even posthumously, even after he's passed, which is a shame it's taken so long, but posthumously pardoned. So, boom.
Better late than never, I suppose.
Anyway, the articles rolled on and on, up and down the country.
Really?
Until Dr. Terence Shuttleworth, aged 55, sadly passed away in London Hospital on the 5th of April, 1993.
That is sad to hear.
Yes, but what is more sad is that it took his death for the newspapers to turn to many of his former patients who gave Dr. Shuttleworth glowing reviews. A mother of three who had been treated by Dr. Shuttleworth told the Chatham News, and I quote, "Mr. Shuttleworth was a smashing, lovely man, and you cannot find anyone who would say different." Shortly after his death, Dr. Terence Shuttleworth was cremated in a private ceremony with family only. Articles that followed after Dr. Terence Shuttleworth's death stated 1,613 women requested HIV tests and not a single one tested positive. Over 10,000 people called the AIDS helpline, of which, over 2 years after the death of Dr. Shuttleworth, Medway Health Authority was billed £150,000 for the helpline.
And I see 5 months after Dr. Shuttleworth's death, hundreds of people packed out Rochester Cathedral in a service of remembrance for the late doctor.
Yes, a service that took place on Saturday the 25th of September 1993 at 3:15 in the afternoon. Dr. Shuttleworth's local paper, the Chatham Standard, reported, "The tribute came at Rochester Cathedral when hundreds of mourners gathered at a Thanksgiving service to pay their respects to the 55-year-old gynaecologist. Friend, neighbour and colleague John Beavis, a consultant orthopaedic surgeon for Medway Health Authority, described Tim Shuttleworth as a great surgeon and doctor whose concern was always for the patient. Mr. Beavis said the day when everyone discovered Mr. Shuttleworth had the virus as a day when those who cared for him were shattered and a day that we will never forget. He said, I know that Tim behaved in a manner that was totally admirable. He was given the chance of anonymity and he fought what was best for the patient. It had been a totally courageous decision."
You know, there really was no justification for how the press turned the lives of all three men and their families upside down.
Exactly.
Having their private lives and their HIV status so publicly dragged through the tabloid press.
You know, if only the British press had taken note of what Dr. Peter Curran told one newspaper back in July 1992, then perhaps all of this could have been avoided and these men's private lives could have been spared. as Dr. Peter Curran said, my antibody status for HIV is the same as yours. Confidential.
All of the actual newspaper articles mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to AIDS, The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in do you believe in life after love, oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.